You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's guest, Greg Dolan.
I clerk for this court. I love this court. I think it's important. And I don't want to see it destroyed, right? Maybe it's inevitable. And maybe if the cost of preserving the constitutional structure of our country is destruction of this court, I'm going to pay that cost. And I think most people should be willing to pay that cost. But it's a very, very high cost. I don't want to pay it. I'll pay it if I have to. But I don't want to pay it. So ideally, I would like to find a resolution that's palatable to the court, palatable to Judge Newman, and consistent with the principles underlying the separation of powers in this country.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, don't forget to share it with others, and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today we're joined by Greg Dolan. He's currently a patent law professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law and senior litigation counsel at New Civil Liberties Alliance. He recently spent 2 years as an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the Republic of Palau. And he's currently representing Judge Pauline Newman of the Federal Circuit against efforts to oust her from the court. This is what Professor Josh Blackman wrote about that effort. I do not have any dog in this fight. I know little about patent law, other than the fact that the Supreme Court routinely reverses the Federal Circuit. If Chief Judge Moore succeeds in pushing her colleague to take senior status, a new vacancy would open up. Judge Moore, by pushing out her colleague, is opening a seat for someone else. Judges should have no role in picking their successors, nor should have judges have a role in creating vacancies on their court, in which a more congenial nominees can assume the seat. Chief Judge Kimberly Moore cannot be the judge, jury, and executioner of Judge Newman. Greg, thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I usually say, you know, we're lucky to be joined by the guests, but that doesn't seem like the right language to use under the circumstances. Let's go a little bit back in time. Obviously, you're presenting Judge Newman now, but you used to be a clerk for her. Can you tell us, what does it feel having the responsibility of representing her now? You've known her all these years.
It's a very odd arrangement, in part because it's kind of like, you know, dealing with your former judge is kind of, I suppose, like dealing with your parents, right? No matter how accomplished you are, no matter how much, you know, how old you are, you're still sometimes revert to this parent-child relationship. And so, too, with Judge Newman, we sometimes revert to this judge-law clerk relationship, which, of course, is not the same relationship that we have now. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't call it a nightmare by any chance. I enjoyed my time working for Judge Newman, but it does give me some flashbacks as to, you know, for example, when I provide some drafts to her, and I get back, like, you know, 10 pages of handwritten comments. Which, by the way, I usually termed as minor edits.
Yeah. So have you been close to her all these years since you've clerked for her?
I have. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call us good friends, right? You know, it's our relationship has been very professional, but I would try to see her, you know, when I was in D.C. I've only recently moved back into the city before I was in Baltimore, but we did keep in touch. She has been very gracious. She's written me a number of recommendation letters for a variety of positions, and some of which I've gotten, some of which I haven't. But certainly have followed and stayed in touch with her.
Many others have chosen to stay completely silent, obviously in the Federal Circuit Bar, including many of her other clerks. I mean, you're a practicing attorney. Why weren't you afraid to take on this fight?
I'm lucky. I don't have private clients who pay me money. I litigate for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. And so obviously we do have private clients that we defend against government excesses. But, you know, we are not funded by client fees. We're funded by donations, by people who believe in our mission. And so I don't intend, you know, I don't expect anytime soon to represent some big corporation seeking to uphold or invalidate patents. So I'm not afraid that my representation of Judge Newman will adversely affect my client's interests. So, which, by the way, I guess, and we've mentioned it in some of our submissions to both the district court and the federal circuit, that that is actually a problem. Not that we here at NCLA are unhappy to represent Judge Newman. We're very happy. We're very honored that she chose us. And we know that we will do no worse and likely better than most big law firms, with all respect to those law firms. But it does say something that a lot of law firms declined to take this case. It does say something in terms of the propriety of maintaining this matter in the federal circuit, given that people who might come to Judge Newman's defense, for example, her former law clerks who've interacted with her, who might, for example, submit an affidavit about her mental or physical abilities, people who litigate and who can submit affidavits or testify about Judge Newman's, for example, question it oral argument or the clarity of her opinions or whatever else, are likely reticent to do so because they're worried that that might adversely affect their ability to represent future clients in the federal circuit. And those fears would be much more reduced if this were transferred, and I'm just randomly picking, let's say, a Third Circuit, but it could be like D.C. or anywhere else, in part because those affidavits, those testimonies, et cetera, would be anonymous. Right. And so, for example, if hypothetically, let's say it gets transferred to the D.C. Circuit and say there was a committee of, say, Chief Judge Srinivasan, Judge Wilkins, and, say, Judge Rao, people would come in, they would give their testimony. That committee would decide something, but they would not necessarily reveal back to Judge Moore, Judge Prose, Judge Toronto, et cetera, that this clerk said A and that clerk said B, et cetera.
Have you heard that kind of feedback from people like, I don't want to get involved?
I haven't heard, like, I don't want to get involved, but I have, for example, and I'm not going to name names, but I've had, you know, when this whole thing broke, you know, I've had people reach out to me and say, look, I want to help with you where I can. I'm in this major law firm and that medium-sized law firm, and we can certainly marshal our resources to do whatever you need us to do, only to be reached, only to be emailed like about a week later saying, I spoke to my partners and, you know, while we're on your side, right, but unfortunately, we can't help. I'm happy to be kind of a private resource. I'm happy to help read your briefs or bounce ideas off of, but we can't really publicly be involved. So I've had those statements made.
From what I understand, the chief complaint against Judge Newman is that she's physically and mentally unable to perform her job as an active judge, and that she's refused to cooperate with Judge Moore's investigation. Let's assume all of that is not true. But what would you say to people who say Judge Newman is 96 years old, she's been on the bench almost 40 years? Isn't it just time sometimes to retire, step aside?
I mean, look, if it were me, I would have retired 20 years ago, taken my lifetime salary I've gotten to, and went to Paris to sip fine wine and coffee on the banks of River Seine. But that's just me. Obviously, Judge Newman has decided to do something different. You know, she has a lot to contribute. I think it's evident from her recent opinions, both her dissents and majority opinions that she's issued in the last few months, even after investigation has begun. You know, I would also note that Supreme Court has just granted cert on an opinion issued by the Federal Circuit en banc in 2022, also right before this investigation began, where Judge Newman was in dissent. And although, of course, we can't predict how Supreme Court would rule, as you quoted Judge Blackmun, the Federal Circuit is often reversed. And as a general matter, Supreme Court doesn't grant cases all that often to affirm, right? They grant to, especially en banc opinions, they grant to reverse, which again suggests that if Judge Newman comes out on the right side of the law, whereas 10 of her colleagues come out on the wrong side of the law, it does say something. Although again, remains to be seen. But is it time to retire? I think it's a very individualized approach. Like I said, for me, I would probably want to do it. But then again, I was never in that position. Maybe I wouldn't. But Judge Newman obviously has made a different choice. She's mentioned in a number of interviews that, you know, maybe if she had a family, if she had grandchildren, maybe she would be thinking differently. But that's not a choice she made in her life. And so she wants to keep contributing, especially with her unique voice on matters of patent law, veterans law, etc. So that's what I would say. I mean, like, your mileage may vary, but ultimately, Judge Newman is the one who was confirmed to the bench, and it's up to her to decide when to step down.
A lot of those media interviews that Judge Newman has been doing, I think one of the things that she said, and correct me if you think I'm misstating it, is that in some ways she sees herself as a singular figure, that her voice matters, and if she steps aside, there'll be some harm. Judges Michelle, Rader, O'Malley, they've all retired. Why does she see her role different?
Well, I don't think she necessarily thinks herself as some sort of the only person in the world who knows what's right. I think she's sufficiently humble to understand that, you know, obviously sometimes she gets things right and sometimes she gets things wrong. But I think it's beyond dispute that she's a unique figure. Now, one can agree with her opinions or one can agree with majority's opinions, etc. But she does provide a unique voice on that court. And this is particularly important given that in a federal circuit, as of course you know, there are no circuit splits, right? So, for example, if you have, let's pick a random circuit. For example, if you have a fairly uniform set of views, let's say on the Eighth Circuit, it's not that much of a problem because odds are, you know, those views may be challenged by a judge in the First, Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Ninth, Tenth, and Eleventh Circuits, right? One of them. It's not likely to happen in a federal circuit. So, you know, can Judge Newman be replaced by somebody younger who will be similar? Anything is possible. But the bottom line is that Judge Newman is indeed a unique voice, whether some people like to hear it or not. And I think that voice makes a contribution to the development of the areas of the law for which federal circuit is responsible.
Then you clerked for Judge Newman. Do you remember anything about the relationship between the judges at that time that stands out to you? You've also clerked at the Fourth Circuit, so I don't know if it was the same or different.
It was a little different, in part because the Fourth Circuit was very, very genteel, even if opinions sometimes were biting. But it's kind of, they pride themselves in being very genteel. For example, it's a Fourth Circuit tradition that after every oral argument, the judges come off the bench to shake counsel's hand and thank him for their argument and say that it was a pleasure to listen to them, no matter how bad or good the argument may have been. But it's still different because Fourth Circuit is spread over five states, right? Maryland, both Virginias, and both Carolinas. And judges really only come together, I think, six or seven times a year for about a week. They don't sit during the summer, so they sit like September, October, November, I think December, January, March, and April, something like that. So all the communications are done by memos. The Federal Circuit, obviously, lots of things is done by memo or by email, but judges do walk to each other's offices. They have lunch together. It's a bit more, at least at that time, it seemed a bit more collegial court. That having been said, Judge Newman, having been there for so long, certainly wouldn't say that she has no friends, but a lot of her, in fact, this actually was true with my judge in the Fourth Circuit. He was also older, so he was a Nixon appointee. And so he was also not quite complaining, but he was, let's say, lamenting the fact that a lot of his friends with whom he kind of came up were no longer on the court. But Judge Newman, I think, generally has been very much kind of somebody who keeps her own counsel. She's not necessarily a vivacious person. She's very pleasant. She's wonderful. She enjoys the opera. She is able to have conversation on a variety of topics. But she's not, as they say, a hail fellow well met, right? She's a bookworm.
She's not doing it to get attention, I guess.
No. She's not like, for example, I used to intern on the Federal Circuit when I was in law school, and I interned for Judge Gallarza. Judge Gallarza was kind of very similar, and that's why he was friends with Justice Scalia, right? He was a bon vivant. He was, an extrovert. And Judge Newman is not, and there's nothing wrong with that. And so in terms of relationship on the court, I don't think there was anything venomous, at least as I could perceive as a clerk. But I will tell you this, in terms of kind of one of the allegations against Judge Newman is she has extraordinary delays. I can tell you that was true in terms of, delays or kind of, maybe not delays, but multiple drafts of opinions and kind of a really evolution in thinking, sometimes changing your opinion as the opinions get drafted 15 years ago. And it was infuriating to be her law clerk. Because sometimes we would draft something, she would change it. Then, a few months later, she thought about it some more. She would change it back. And I'm like, well, why couldn't we just go with my original draft? And I have no idea how this is ever going to come out in a normal opinion because it's just like also notes on the side. And to me, it seemed like a crazy process. But at the end, it worked. And so I've kind of resigned myself to the notion that maybe I don't know as much as I think I know because I'm just out of law school for a couple of years. Whereas Judge Newman, by that point, had been on the bench for like 30 years or something like that, or 25 years. So it worked. Was it an easy process? No. Was it kind of always a smooth process? No. But I kind of read a lot of these complaints about Judge New, and I'm like, yeah, that was a Wednesday for us, right? There's nothing new here.
The first two people that I interviewed on this podcast are actually judges, Rader and Michelle. And one of the themes of what they talked about is the decline of a federal circuit. Is this a symptom of that?
Any behavior like this would signal significant deterioration of any court or any kind of collegial body. Honestly, I am just worried about what happens, whether it stays with the federal circuit or gets transferred. Imagine a world where Judge Newman is exonerated and says, like, for example, if she does go to the medical testing that was requested and gets a clean bill of health, or if the federal circuit accepts the test that she submitted, how do they go back to acting like normal colleagues after this public spat? How do they go back and be cordial and collegial to each other on the bench? And how do they kind of deal with it without it affecting litigants? I know that Judge Newman is capable of doing this. I suspect maybe so is Judge Moore, but it's not gonna, it's not one of those things where, well, I don't know, I came to your house, I simply broke your vase and apologized and that was it, right? This is much deeper. And I think this has poisoned the well in the federal circuit. I think it's gonna take a long time to heal. And I don't think it's for the better, either for the flourishing of the court or development of the law. I think it's an unnecessary self-inflicted wound.
Hearing you say that, it makes me think, well, maybe is it better to just say Judge Moore is completely wrong, but for the institution to say, I'll step aside and hopefully they can find a way to fix it? Or is dragging this on in this way causing its own harms?
I mean, I think it is causing harm, but I don't think it's Judge Newman's role to step aside for several reasons. One, there are broader issues at stake, specifically, there are serious constitutional issues about what power do fellow judges have in terms of sidelining one of their own. Obviously, the Constitution grants Congress the power to impeach and remove judges, but if we allow fellow judges to do that, that's dangerous, right? Imagine, for example, right now, let's go back to Eighth Circuit. I don't know why I pick on it, but just so happens.
I'm impressed with all the circuits you're able to keep track of.
So Eighth Circuit currently has, I forget how many judges they have total, but all but one of their judges are appointees of Republican presidents. Imagine if the judges get together and say, we're just sick of the judge who's more liberal than us, kind of probably doesn't quite align with us. So we'll just declare that person to be incompetent and no review, no anything. Now, it sounds far-fetched, and I hope it is. But, human nature is such that power once granted tends to be eventually abused. And so Judge Newman is standing up not just for herself. She could have gone senior, like I said, she could have gone senior 20 years ago. She could have gone senior now, become a mediator. She could go lecture. Any law school would love to have her. Certainly, if she chose to retire, I would do my best to have her hired in my law school to teach patent law. It's not a problem, right? She could go senior. She could sit by designation on other circuits. But it's a fundamental issue of the structure of the American government. And I think Judge Newman knows that. So between those two unpalatable options, hurting the court, which she created in some sense and loves, and hurting the entire structure of American government, you choose the lesser of two evils. And I think option A is the lesser of two evils.
This whole story unfolded, at least publicly, like out of a movie. Jean Quinn broke the story about this complaint. Next thing you know, Judge Newman travels up to New York, shows up at a conference, undermines the foundation of that complaint that somehow she's physically and mentally unable to perform her duties. I saw Judge O'Malley sitting next to her, a lot of affection and admiration towards Judge Newman. When did you first find out about this whole effort?
About that time. I don't remember exactly when, but right before she traveled to New York. So a couple of days before that.
Did she call you or how did you?
She called, okay. Yeah.
What was your reaction to that news?
I mean, I couldn't believe it, in part because just about a month or two before that, I had lunch with Judge Newman and a couple of her current clerks and a couple of her former clerks. For example, Professor Andrew Michaels, one of who wrote recently an article about analyzing Judge Newman's dissents, was at that lunch as well. A couple of other people who've been close to Judge Newman throughout. We went out to Cosmos Club for a lovely lunch. I think Judge Newman was, you know, she used to live in France, so she was very good at picking wines. I wasn't having one because I had to go back to work. You know, it was just a lovely, lovely lunch, and nothing hinted at this notion that she has any mental problems. Now, when I got the call, I thought, like, okay, well, I don't think that's true, but things happen. And she was at the time 95. And so I wanted to talk to her, and I wanted kind of like to see what is the basis for any of this. And so the more I looked, you know, the more I looked at it, the less I saw. There's no there. And again, if the complaint is that she's being slow, I mean, then where were these judges 20 years ago? Right? That she always is a bit slower because she always dissents more. And if you dissent, of course, you have to wait for the majority opinion to come in first and then, you know, respond to it and then think about it. And sometimes she double checks herself. Like, I can tell you, we had this one case. I'm not going to name names. But we had a case that was argued when I was a law clerk. The judges deliberated. They reached a certain decision. I kind of liked the case because it had some sort of interesting jurisdictional issues in it. And I asked the judge that, look, if you're in a majority, could you please assign it to yourself? Because I would like to work on it. And that's exactly what happened. It was a 3-0 majority. She assigned it to herself. I drafted that opinion. I was excited about it. Sent it to her. A couple months passed by because, again, she was working on something else. I got back a draft. The same side won, but in a completely different theory. And I went back and forth with the judge. I said, like, judge, I don't think that's what the panel agreed to. I don't think that that's necessarily right. But again, of course, you're the judge and you get to decide. And so ultimately, we circulated to the panel the draft that she wanted. And the panel basically had the same reaction as I did and said, like, well, that's not what we agreed to. We understand the same side wins, but that's not a, you know, Russia DCND that we agreed on. And Judge Newman said, well, you know, if I can't get another judge to join me, then I'm kind of essentially in quasi-dissent or maybe concurrence in judgment. So it was reassigned to a different judge who then drafted the majority opinion as was initially agreed to. Judge assigned me to write this concurrence / dissent. I was working and working on it and kind of it wasn't really coming along because I thought that the majority was having a better argument. But I was trying to do the judge's kind of bidding. Finally, I did it, gave it to her. It sat on her desk for a while. And then one morning, I come into the office, see the email from the judge to the other panel members that says, look, on further reflection, I've decided to join the majority. Right? So she kind of went full circle. Now, again, some people, and it met me at the time, I found it to be kind of infuriating because we could have had this opinion. It could have been something that came out of our chambers, etc. But that's Judge Newman's process. She really thinks deeply about these issues, and she checks herself. And sometimes she decides that she was wrong initially, and then she decides that, no, you know, upon further research, further reflection, further discussion with her law clerks, she changes her mind again. And it's not because she doesn't know the law. It's because she really cares about getting it right. And yes, that takes time. So, you know, so like I said, the more I looked, the less I saw, because everything, all of these complaints that were leveled against Judge Newman seemed like normal operating procedure for her chambers for quite some time.
Federal Circuit judges talk publicly, but talk about the enormous workload they have. What do you think could be motivating Judge Moore to start this effort on top of her work, start this, convince a bunch of other judges on the court to back this? What could it be that kind of is motivating this kind of unprecedented series of events?
Yeah, look, I don't want to second guess Judge Moore. I presume good faith, whether or not it's warranted in this case, you know, people can make their own judgment. But I presume good faith. Judge Moore is a federal judge nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, with almost two decades of experience. So I don't want to go around saying that she's doing for some sort of nefarious issues. Maybe Judge Moore really does see a problem. And that's fine. And she can make her concerns known. And if the case would have been transferred, she could have put down, you know, her own affidavit, an affidavit of Judge Prost and Toronto and Cunningham and whoever else is on the court, Judge Lurie, right, and everybody else. And then the whatever circuit it would be transferred to could have evaluated, could have talked to Judge Newman, could have analyzed her dissents. So, and that could have been done. So what's motivating Judge Moore? I don't know. Maybe she's frustrated that it takes longer time to issue opinions whenever Judge Newman was on the panel. Maybe she's frustrated that, Judge Newman tends to dissent so often and even on, quote unquote, non-controversial cases. Maybe there's some personal rivalry. I don't know. I don't want to ascribe to Judge Moore views that are, you know, that I don't have solid
sure, evidence. Yeah. It's not like something happened with them that Judge Newman thinks might have occurred.
It may have been, but not that I know of. But I think it's not inconceivable that one of the reasons Judge Moore is moving against Judge Newman is because she does want the court sort of to get more sort of modern, more, you know, replenished with new blood. And, you know, but again, it's not her choice to make.
Yeah. Why not at least transfer the review to another circuit? Wouldn't that just be easier? You know, let them, this is my good faith belief about what should happen. Here are the facts and let them handle it and figure it out.
Your guess is as good as mine. I never understood it, in part because, look, when I was a judge, granted, it was a very small place. But it was a wonderful 2 years that I spent. But, you know, I just like in my every other job, I wanted to do as little work as possible while kind of having the largest impact as possible. I wanted to go diving when I was in Palau and kind of get out of the office early. And yes, while on the court, I had to sit as a judge on various disciplinary complaints against attorneys. And I tried to kind of get them off my desk as quickly as I could, not to ignore evidence of wrongdoing, but just not to drag it out. And so, again, if I were in Judge Moore's place, if for no other reason, it's just like to avoid doing the work and to avoid poisoning the well, I'd just say, like, look, let somebody else deal with this. Maybe she thought it could be handled kind of quietly and collegially, but once that didn't work, right, once we specifically asked for a transfer, once it was clear that Judge Newman is not going to accede to the committee's unwarranted demands, wouldn't discretion be better part of valor? So, and I've been asking this question a number of times in my written submissions, in my other communications with the committee, and I just don't understand. The best they could give me is this notion that, and I think that's in the order of, I think it's May 3rd, publicly released order of May 3rd. They say, like, well, other judges on other courts don't have sufficient familiarity with how we do things and our personalities, et cetera. And I'm like, but that's the reason to transfer, precisely because they're not familiar. They're not biased one way or the other. That's what you want in a judge. You don't want to go to a judge who is your next door neighbor and comes over to your house for dinner, right? You want an unbiased judge. So I'm as much baffled as you are. It makes no sense to me.
It's like picking a jury who has very strong opinions about the matter.
It makes no sense to me.
You know, but after Judge Newman called you to tell you about the situation, did you discuss or consider her taking senior status?
Judge Newman, I think she's mentioned in several interviews that as soon as she feels that she's unable to do this work, she will step down that very day. She's not holding on to this. This is not like it was in whatever it was, 19th century, when lots of judges stayed on even when they were completely disabled because there was no pension for judges, right? So if you wanted basically to have any source of income, you had to hold on to your office for dear life. She doesn't have to. She's guaranteed her income for life however long she lives, whether she's on the court or not. Would she consider senior status? I think she would if she felt unable to keep up with the court's work. There is, however, a wrinkle. So the assignment of cases to a senior status judge is almost entirely the discretion of the chief judge of that court. And given the poisoned atmosphere, yeah. I think there is serious concern that if Judge Newman were to take senior status, she would be completely sidelined by Judge Moore, which is not what she's willing to do. Because, again, I think she believes, and I think she believes correctly, that she does have a voice and thoughts to offer to the court and the nation.
The whole situation obviously must be incredibly difficult for Judge Newman. She has devoted her life to the Federal Circuit. Colleagues turn on her. Can you tell us a little bit about how she's been able to deal with it? Has she been surprised about how the dynamics have unfolded within the court?
I think she's, again, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn because a lot of it is in already public interviews that she's conducted. I think she's been kind of floored by these allegations because they did seem to come out of nowhere. I think she's surprised that the court, that nobody on the court has kind of spoken on her behalf. Although I think that's explainable by the fact that, again, if I were on that court, now I would certainly hope that I would be a bit more forward because I'm much like Judge Newman. Perhaps that's why we got along so well. I'm also a contrarian. I also kind of want to go against the grain sometimes. But I think a lot of people, and judges are no exception, they want to come in to work in a pleasant atmosphere, not in a poison atmosphere. And so just making a basic calculation, who's going to stay in the court longer, Judge Newman or Judge Moore, and who would you rather have a better relationship with? Just doing actuarial tables, it's going to be likely Judge Moore. And so if you have to choose sides, and all you want is kind of peace and quiet and ability to do your work as a judge, it makes sense that you would choose Judge Moore's side without necessarily, without necessarily believing the full scope of allegations. But no, Judge Newman was very surprised. It has been hard.
What you're saying is that there's a possibility of judges not willing to do the right thing for other reasons, right? And you think...
I think that's right. Again, I don't want to...
No, I understand. Yeah, but...
I don't know what's going through any judge's mind, but... Yes, and again, all the more reason to transfer this because judges may have their own kind of selfish interest, which they may not even necessarily recognize, right? That's part of the human psyche. You think you're doing the right thing, but really what's affecting your judgment is kind of considerations of that are extraneous to what the right thing is, right? I mean, there's a reason why, we, for example, don't allow judges to sit on cases in which they have financial stake. Right. I would imagine that most judges up and down the federal or even state chain would say, yeah, sure. I own 1,000 shares of stocks in Microsoft, but I would never rule simply based on the fact that my stock will go up or down in a case where Microsoft was a plaintiff or defendant. I'm a judge. I take my responsibilities seriously. And we can even believe that statement. And yet we say, yeah, OK, we believe you. But, still, you shouldn't sit on this case because it's just too tempting. It's just too tempting for you to put your thumb on a scale. And same thing here. I'm not saying that Judge Moore or Judge Lori or Judge, it's been a while since I've looked at the updated list, or Judge Prost or any of the judges like that. They're purposefully trying to to do something nefarious. I'm just saying the temptation is so large that... to go along to get along, right? That's what might be happening.
So since you've been representing Judge Newman, have you been able to talk to, the special committee of judges? I'm not sure if I'm referring it correctly or whatever. Have you been able to talk to them directly?
Yes. I can say that we had a hearing, again, because this is public, I can say that we had a hearing before that committee on July 13th. So just over just under 2 weeks ago, I can't discuss the contents of the hearing because I'm under essentially a secrecy order. But we had a hearing. We sort of discussed, as the committee set in the initial order schedule in the hearing, the public order, Judge Newman, quote unquote, alleged lack of cooperation. So I was able to see the committee face to face. I wouldn't necessarily say I was able to talk to them because it was not a conversation. It was much more akin to a oral argument with only one side, right? And so they asked me questions. I didn't quite get to ask them questions. But yes, we got chance to see each other face to face.
And obviously this is a unique process, but is there any chance of some cooler heads saying, can we negotiate some kind of reasonable resolution to this?
I hope so. I mean, as you know, or maybe not, but Judge Newman filed a lawsuit in the District Court for the District of Columbia, and Judge Cooper, who's a presiding judge in that case, has been assigned to that case, has ordered an informal mediation before the former judge of the D.C. Circuit, Judge Thomas Griffith, and that has been scheduled for August 3rd. Yeah, I'm not going to get into details because we promised Judge Griffith and both parties promised each other to maintain the confidentiality precisely to try to get to that point of mutual kind of, you know, compromise. I don't know that the committee would move. I mean, we've offered multiple off-ramps. We've offered transfers and off-ramp. We've offered the report of Dr. Rothstein. Right, that could have been said, you know, they could have said, you know what, that's not the doctor we wanted, that maybe not the test we wanted, but kind of good enough for government work.
I want to ask about that because Judge Newman said that you're the one who convinced her to take that test. Can you tell us about that? How do you convince Judge Newman to do that?
I'm not happy that Judge Newman kind of discussed attorney-client privileges, so I'm not gonna follow her example on this one. I'll just say that, look, making sure that she's in good health and, or at least sufficiently good health and able to do the job is important, not just to Judge Moore. It's important to Judge Newman herself. And one of the ways to assure everyone, including herself, that that is the case, right, was to see Dr. Rothstein, right? And Dr. Rothstein put his, you know, Dr. Rothstein is not some fly-by-night person. He's a full professor of neurology with decades and decades of experience whose specialization is in dementia. Right? And he was willing to put his professional reputation on the line, on his letterhead, on George Washington's letterhead, to say that Judge Newman is able to continue her work as a federal judge. So, like I said, that was another off-ramp. The special committee could have said, you know, that's not what we asked Judge Newman to do. That's not ideal. That's not whatever. But like I said, good enough for government work. And let's just close shop right here. We haven't seen that. You know, obviously, like I said, we had this hearing on the 13th. We haven't had a result of the hearing yet. So there's not been any decisions or recommendations by the committee. So maybe they will. Maybe that's what will happen in mediation. I have no idea. But on one hand, I hope that cooler heads will prevail and maybe Judge Griffith will be able to come up with a solution that neither side has been able to see on their own. They'll be palatable for both sides. We began with that. I clerk for this court. I love this court. I think it's important. And I don't want to see it destroyed, right? Maybe it's inevitable. And maybe if the cost of preserving the constitutional structure of our country is destruction of this court, I'm willing to pay that cost, and I think most people should be willing to pay that cost. But it's a very, very high cost. I don't want to pay it. I'll pay it if I have to, but I don't want to pay it. So ideally, I would like to find a resolution that's palatable to the court, palatable to Judge Newman, and consistent with the principles underlying the separation of powers in this country. So we'll see. I don't want to say I have doubts. Unfortunately, I'm apprehensive that the special committee that was given a number of off-ramps will take this one. But then again, maybe when talking to a fellow judge or former judge who's disinterested in the actual outcome of this litigation, maybe they will listen.
From my viewpoint, and I know very little compared to you, but you would hope that if this is a good faith effort that they undertook, they must really believe it, right? Can't kind of like, oh, let's figure this out. Let's figure this out if Judge Newman is up to the job or not. When they undertook it, they must have thought, if it was a good faith effort, that they didn't think she should be on the court as an active judge. What do you think? How could they take the off ramp now?
Well, look, I'll quote one of my favorite movies, A Few Good Men, if you remember the scene with Tom Cruise says, look, it doesn't matter what I believe. It only matters what I can prove, right? So, I am willing to give the committee benefit of the doubt, although kind of my willingness is wearing thinner and thinner with every day. I'm willing to say that Judge Moore, when she began this investigation, does and maybe continues to believe that Judge Newman is not fully capable of doing the work. And maybe so do other judges, although not sure what all the other judges have seen. The issue, though, is not what Judge Moore believes. The issue is what is the power that she has as a matter of constitutional law. I'm very skeptical, and I know the statute allows for suspension of judges, but I'm very skeptical that that power is constitutional. Judge Moore is certainly free, either alone or together with 11 of her other colleagues, to submit a report to U.S. House of Representatives saying Judge Newman is unable to do her job and you should consider impeachment. Now, of course, we would dispute it, but as a matter of kind of constitutional laws and that whether she's acting as a chief judge of the court or even as a private citizen, she, of course, has a right to petition her own government, including for impeachment of a federal judge. If Judge Moore wants to kind of publicize the finding, I suppose, and hope that Judge Newman takes them into account and decides to retire, maybe that's okay, too. The problem is that right now, Judge Moore has suspended, together with her colleagues, has suspended Judge Newman even before any investigation has been concluded. Right? The imposed punishment, there was sentence first, verdict afterwards. And ultimately, going to your questions, too, how can, if they believe this, if they truly believe it, how can they back away from this now? I think it's rather simple. You can say, look, we believe that there's a real problem. We have documentation that there's a real problem. Again, I'm not conceding that there's a problem. Actually, I think it's so disputed, but from their perspective, they can say there's a real problem. Here's all of our voluminous evidence. We can give it to Congress. We can give it to another court. We're willing to testify. We're willing to come on the Hill. We're willing to come to another special committee, provide our evidence, and let a neutral body make that assessment. And, you know, and that doesn't undermine their beliefs. They don't have to say that, oh, we were wrong all along. They can say, well, we're right all along, but we should not be the one making the decision.
What about from Judge Newman's perspective? You mentioned that there's problems with her going senior status. Do you think something like that could be negotiated where she'll go senior status, but she'll get randomly cases or anything like that? Is that within the realm of possibilities?
I mean, I think if Judge Newman is willing to go senior status, I'll just give you this. I think if she was willing to go senior status, she probably would have gone it without, you know, going through this humiliating process, right? Again, I think I can speak for Judge Newman on this. She's absolutely willing to take not just senior status, but full retirement the moment she's not able to do this job. She doesn't want anyone to, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, to question whether or not their patent was upheld by a judge who was not mentally competent to do so, or vice versa, invalidated by somebody who was not mentally competent. That would be a huge stain on her legacy. That would be a huge disservice to the country that she has served for decades. And I don't think she wants that. But so long as she can serve, right, she intends to continue doing that. Whether or not something, you know, some kind of agreement could be negotiated in terms of, for example, that she will have to do, you know, turn her case around in X number of days, and if not, then she would have to skip sittings or whatever. I don't want to get involved. I think there are ways to kind of to address the court's concerns when it comes to delays, but I don't think senior status is necessarily one of them, at least right now.
Remaining as an active judge with a reduced workload or something like that.
Yeah, not even necessarily with a reduced workload, but, you know, the Federal Circuit has a rule saying that if you have a certain number of cases over a certain number of days, then you get to skip the next sitting. You know, maybe that rule has to be enforced, you know, more thoroughly, or maybe the number of days can be short, or whatever it is. right? I think there are ways to make sure Judge Newman is on time and kind of an sort of, or whatever the concern is that, you know, that she's not pulling her weight. But I, you know, there are ways to negotiate that. I don't think that there are, as I think, as she mentioned in one of her interviews, Judge Moore's initial position was that, well, everything is negotiable except the demand that she retire from active status. And I think that's, you know, that's not a position from which you negotiate, right? If your non-negotiable demand is retirement, and if that continues to be demand, I don't think we're going to get very far.
Actually, I didn't realize, but I thought actually the special committee, when it's done, if it's finished its work and it agrees with initial complaint, it would refer to impeachment proceedings. Is that a possibility that they would do a suspension without kind of say, no, nobody else take a look at it?
Right, technically, no. So technically, it's a multi-step process. So it's a special committee that makes recommendations, judicial counsel of the relevant circuit. So in this case, obviously, the Federal Circuit, which can then impose penalties, leaving aside constitutional concerns. The judge, the subject judge, can appeal to the Nationwide Committee on Judicial Disability and Misconduct, currently chaired by Judge Traxler of the Fourth Circuit, which can then affirm, reverse, or modify the decision of the Judicial Council. Judicial Council can also, to the extent they think there's impeachable conduct, refer the matter to the Judicial Conference of the United States, who then decides whether or not to refer it to the House. So it's a multi-step process. So it's because not every misconduct necessarily is impeachable. So, for example, a number of years ago, Judge Calabresi of the Second Circuit made some ill-advised comments on a political matter about, I think, somewhere around the year 2000, maybe 2004, about George Bush's election. And he went through this process and he apologized and he was kind of reprimanded or just, he had a finger shook at him. But obviously this was not impeachable conduct. It was inadvisable. It kind of put the court and the justice system in a bad light. And he was so told publicly. It was embarrassing, but no, it didn't go to the House for impeachment. So not every misconduct necessarily gets referred to the House.
Are you and Judge Newman imagining the scenario where this would go for an impeachment proceeding?
We haven't. I mean, we've imagined it only insofar as we know that that is a legal possibility. I honestly think if this were referred to the impeachment proceedings, I think that report would be left out of the Hall of Congress.
I'm not sure they'd notice. But
I mean, there have been comments, for example, Representative Jordan, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, has said that he doesn't think Judge Newman ought to be pressured into stepping down. That if she wants to step down, she should. But, you know, he thinks that she's doing a fine job. So, unless there's some, you know, irrefutable evidence of Judge Newman, you know, walking around hallways and thinking that she's speaking to dead people and, you know, thinking that this is 1912, whatever, right? Something absolutely beyond the pale, I think it would be laughed at in Congress. And so that also tells me something, and not because, for example, Judge Newman is liked by Representative Jordan or whatever else, but because it's not a case where it's pretty clear that this judge shouldn't be doing the job. I think one can argue whether or not Judge Newman is at the very top of her game, or maybe at 80%, or like it's 90% or 75% of her peak. But I think it's undisputable that Judge Newman, based on the opinions that she's recently put out, majority, dissents, concurrences, Judge Newman is fully competent, fully able to grasp the legal issues, fully able to write about those legal issues. And if my gut is correct, have her views affirmed by the Supreme Court in contravention to her colleagues.
Another interesting story in the chain of events. The suit that you filed in district court, I guess, then is pretty important in terms of what will happen with the decision of the special committee in terms of do they have the power or not. Embarrassing to admit, but I actually never knew that a federal judge could be kicked out by other judges. I actually always thought it was a...
Yeah, nobody knew. That's kind of, you know, and I've talked to a number of federal judges who I'm friendly with or who, like, in various, like, meetings, just kind of about the process, because it was new to me as well. And all of them were kind of like, this is so super odd, right? They all knew kind of that, of course, the judiciary is tasked with investigating their own, that, you know, if somebody, like, for example, Judge Rader had an issue that he had to apologize for, that he wrote an email to a litigant saying how he did a great job at oral argument, and that was deemed to be unseemly, and so, you know, it was brought to the attention of his own court, and he then apologized, and he agrees it was unseemly. So, you know, and I very much like Judge Rader. I think he was a great judge. I think he's a good friend. So I was sorry that this would tarnish his reputation, but nobody disputed that, of course, his own court should call attention to people overstepping their bounds. And that is entirely appropriate. But removing judges or removing them at all by name, that's, I think, a step too far.
The chief judge actually assigns the cases to the senior judges. That's a pretty big power, right? It's kind of like...
It's an enormous power.
She's almost a panelist on these, the arm's length panelist on these decisions.
Well, so I don't want to oversell it. I don't know if the chief judge assigns senior judges to specific panels. I think chief judge decides whether or not they will actually sit. So I think once she decides, for example, the chief judge says, okay, I'm going to assign, let's say, Judge Lynn, right? One panel in October, I think he just goes into, I guess it used to be a hat or a drum. Now it's a computer program. He just goes in and gets basically pulled out like any other judge. I don't think she purposefully handpicked saying, oh, Judge Lynn is going to sit with this judge or that judge in here, like three veterans cases and like one patent case and zero, whatever.
Yeah. But I think we've seen some controversy surrounding that. A decision was made. One of the judges, I think, retired. Then the chief judge has the power to decide what happens with that decision. On the district court, I don't know if you followed it, but with, you know, Judge Albright, right? In the Western District of Texas, the chief judge made a new rule about how patent cases would be assigned there. Going through this, being so close to this, any thoughts? Do chief judges on district courts or in circuits have too much power?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on a court and depends on the kind of, on the internal court proceedings. So I don't know if you remember, but back in kind of early 2000s, there were lots of complaints about former Chief Judge Boggs of the Sixth Circuit and that how he allegedly manipulated panels on, especially when kind of big affirmative action and death penalty cases came up before the Sixth Circuit, so Grutter and Gratz. And again, I don't have any particular inside knowledge whether or not this actually did or did not happen, but people who are interested can read Judge Boggs's dissent and appendix to his dissent in the Grutter and Gratz cases. So there have been complaints that judges, chief judges may have a bit too much power, or at least some of them have misused it. I don't know that that is happening in the Federal Circuit. I don't want to make allegations when I don't have all the facts, but certainly it's chief judge is supposed to be an administrator and not kind of somebody who puts his thumb on a scale as to, for example, how often a particular judge sits. And so that's one of the other issues. So I may have already mentioned it, but you know, one of the allegations against Judge Newman is that she hasn't sat as often as other judges. So other judges sat on average, I forget the number, but 100 odd cases, and she only sat on about 60 in the last year or so. Well, at least when I was on the court, the way it worked is that every month the call would go out basically saying, we're now putting a calendar, sitting calendar for 2 months from now. So right now that would be early August, they'll be asking for the October sitting. And saying, how many days would you like to sit? And there's some internal court rules that over the course of a year, each active judge has to sit on whatever number of panels, right? And so, for example, some judges just don't like sitting in the summer. They have their summer cottages, they want to go there, and kind of double up for the first 9 months, right? They say, I would sit instead of 2 days a month, I'll sit 3 days so that my summer, other judges spread it throughout because, you know, they're not going anywhere, etc. So each judge writes a letter or email saying, I'm willing to sit, let's say, 2 days or 3 days or 5 days this month, whenever you need. And Judge Newman consistently for the last 40 years have been basically saying, I'm going to sit 3 to 4 days or as needed. And then once those emails go out, kind of the office of the chief judge, my understanding was, I could be wrong, but the office of the clerk, kind of they look at these availabilities, they look at the number of cases that are available, and they assign cases. Again, not specifically, like, you sit on this panel, you sit on that panel, but saying, let's say Judge Newman requested three, but say during COVID, there was just not enough cases to assign you to three, so you get two panels, right? So kind of availability is the cap, and then you get as many as are available. The reason I'm saying all of this is that allegation that Judge Newman has sat on fewer panels is something that was done to her. It's not that she can just show up in a courtroom, pull up a chair and say, I think I'm going to hang out on this panel and decide this case, right? Yeah. It's not how it works. So to the extent that chief judges use the power to sideline some of their colleagues, and for example, when they're asking to sit on three panels a month, only giving them one panel or whatever, that is indeed a problem. Again, don't know exactly how the details are working within the federal circuit, but my recollection that when I was a clerk, that's roughly how it worked. And to the extent that Judge Newman is not getting her full set of requested panels, I think the blame cannot possibly be laid at Judge Newman's feet, and most likely is at the chief's. Even if she's not herself saying, okay, don't put Judge Newman on the panels, ultimately she is the chief administrator of the court. It is her court she's supposed to run.
I mean, beyond the federal circuit, I think you've mentioned there's obviously bigger, as important as you think patent issues are, there are many more very important decisions, issues, the whole judiciary that everybody trusts in America, whatever you think about this station, you know, it's hard to argue that America has one of the, probably the best judicial system in the world. Do you think there's some structural changes that need to happen about how this is organized, about legislation or otherwise, in terms of the power provided to those chief judges, or maybe it's not possible?
Yeah, I haven't thought about it that deeply. There are, you know, I've talked to some people as I began to represent Judge Newman, not necessarily with respect to her case, but kind of seeing the problems that arise. Maybe having chief judges assigned by seniority is not ideal. Maybe having the court elect a chief judge, like, for example, say, Supreme Court of Wisconsin, they elect a chief justice every, I think, 2 years or 3 years or whatever it is. Maybe that's the way to do it. And so that way, kind of, it's the most people that the entire court trusts and believes that they're going to be fair-minded, etc. Maybe that's the way to do it. Of course, that creates other problems, right? I don't think there's a perfect solution. I think whatever solution we have, right? So, for example, if the court elects, you might end up having people politicking to become the chief judge, and that may create its own problems, right? So, obviously, kind of just doing it purely on age in terms of service, it's neutral, and so, you know, everybody knows who the next chief judge is going to be, absent death or resignation, and, you know, you don't need to create, you know, have your allies or whatever, or blocks. But I think, ultimately, for the system to work, everybody within the system has to have some dose of humility to recognize that they're not, you know, they're not dictators of the court. They're not, princes of the court. They are first among equals, that their job is to make sure that the court works as a whole. And even if you sometimes face with a difficult personality, and again, Judge Newman sometimes is not easy because she is contrarian. She has her own views. Is to ultimately work with everyone on the court for the benefit of the public, and for the benefit of the litigants, for the benefit of the country. And so, you know, I don't think there's any silver bullet solution to saying that, well, if only we had some other system, none of this would ever happen. I think it's just some humility is warranted, and unfortunately, I haven't seen it on this court, at least in this investigation.
One of the things that I mentioned in the introduction, and I think you mentioned along the way, is you used to be an associate justice of a Supreme Court of the Republic of Palau. Can't say I've heard of that before. Can you tell us, how did you end up in that position, and what was that like?
Yeah, so, you know, Palau is a small Pacific Island nation. It used to be U.S. Territory, not quite like, say, Guam or Puerto Rico, but it was a trust territory. So it was, before World War II, it was governed by Japan, under a League of Nations mandate. After World War II, when Japan was defeated, the newly formed United Nations granted United States a trust over several territories in the Pacific. So Federal State of Micronesia is one, Palau is another, Republic of Marshall Islands is another, Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands, I believe, was another. And so CNMI decided to stay in the Commonwealth with the U.S. FSM, Marshall Islands, and Palau decided to go their separate way. But obviously a lot is based on U.S. law because U.S. was a sovereign there for between 1945 and 1994. It's a very small place. It's about only like 20,000 people. As a result, kind of everyone knows everyone. A lot of people are related to each other. And so they like to have at least one judge who's not related to anyone.
Oh, interesting.
And so they recruit.
They thought of the issue that we discussed, I guess, about not being
exactly
too close.
And so the person that replaced me is an American academic. The person who preceded me was an American, not an academic. But and so when the person preceded me retired, they put out a call for applications.
And how long was he there? The person that
he was there longer because he was kind of towards the end of his career. And okay. I was, you know, I could have stayed there for life as well. It was actually an appointment during good behavior, much like in the federal court. But, you know, I had to decide whether to stay there for longer or return to my and resign my tenure at University of Baltimore or to come back. And I decided to come back. I love Palau, but it is very small, especially if you're single. It's very kind of, you have to decide, like, I guess I'm not going to have a family. So it was hard to date for somebody who, like me, when everybody knew who I was, everybody knew what I was doing at any given time, etc. In any event, so my dean sent, so the court sent out call for applications to various law schools. My dean forwarded to me, and I kind of applied on a lark. And
have you heard of it before?
I have, mostly in a, I don't even remember why, but somehow I have heard of Palau existing. And so I thought, like, you know, why not? And, you know, I interviewed and got a job, and it was absolutely lovely. I loved doing the work. I've made some good friends. I hope I've contributed to the development of the law of the Republic. But, yeah, we've had those similar issues where, like you said, some attorneys were complained of and were investigated. Some judges were complained of and being investigated. And so the complaints were lodged against me. Right. Even though I was only for 2 years, and it was politically motivated complaint by another American attorney that was ultimately dismissed. But yeah, I mean, it goes with the territory. So I don't begrudge the fact that complaints are filed and that they have to be, of course, dealt with. And I don't begrudge Judge Moore's ability as a chief judge of the court to have to process those complaints. And if she finds merit, to move them to the next stage. What I begrudge her is the ability to kind of, to, as Josh Blackman said, be judge, jury, and executioner. She thought that these complaints against Judge Newman had merit, should have said so. Said, like, I don't find it to be frivolous, and I'm going to move, and I'm going to ask the Chief Justice of the United States to transfer it elsewhere where somebody can be a proper judge, and if need be, I suppose, an executioner, but not simultaneously a prosecutor and a witness.
Anything that you learn about what it takes to be a great judge?
I mean, I guess, like, it's humility, and it's very hard, right? So all of a sudden, especially like, for me in such a small place, maybe it's a bit easier to see. Maybe then again, it's harder because I don't know. But humility is really important because all of a sudden you come in, you put on this black robe, and everybody starts referring to you as your honor, and everybody starts being deferential to you, and, you know, and I was on the Supreme Court's appellate division, meaning that I was on a court of last resort. So by definition, all of my opinions were right, because there was no final appeal from them. It goes to your head. And so every so often, you need to remind yourself that the only reason, kind of, I think it's Justice Holmes, so it could be, or maybe one of the Supreme Court justices of the United States said it. Look, he said, we're not final because we're infallible. We're only infallible because we're final, right? And you have to kind of remember that the reason people give you deference is not because you're infallible, not because you're kind of the smartest person that ever walked God's green earth, is because you were invested with this power, right? And you have to keep that kind of that sacred trust that you're doing it not for yourself, not for your self-aggrandizement, not to make your own life easier, but you're trying to do right by the people. And so, and it, like I said, it's not easy. Maybe it was a bit easier for me in Palau. Maybe it was a bit harder. Maybe it was easier because, you know, once I left work at 5 p.m., I was still basically hanging out with the same people, going diving or going to a bar. It's like it's a very small crowd, especially a crowd of expats. Maybe it was a bit harder because no matter where I went, everybody knew that I was a judge and everybody addressed me as Your Honor, even though I tried to say, like, please call me by my first name, and it just never happened. In fact, like, I became very good friends with one of the people who clerked for me. We still meet up when I'm in New York. And I'm still saved in her cell phone as Justice Dolan, right? I'm like, even though she calls me by my first name, we send each other memes, right? Like, we go to theaters or restaurants together. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. And there is no silver bullet. It's just remembering that, again, that you were invested with this power as a trust, not because you got some sort of God-given right, or not because necessarily you're the smartest person to ever set foot in that courthouse.
I actually saw somebody post on LinkedIn, there's a district court judge who seems unhappy with the litigant in his court, and he's making their life difficult. And somebody posted, who will blink first? And somebody responded, well, not the guy who can throw people in jail. So right. What is your advice to keep that humility? Obviously, you know, that judge, I'm sure, thinks what they're doing is 100% correct, but they do have enormous power. They must think they're in that position to exercise that power. How do you balance all that?
I think judges should exercise the power that they're given. That's what they're there for. They shouldn't shirk their responsibility. Nothing sort of drives me more up the wall than judges saying, look, how can I avoid deciding the case, right? Maybe if there's a similar case winding its way up the chain to the Supreme Court, maybe if I just sit on mine, I won't have to decide something controversial. That's terrible,
yeah.
Right? You should use the power that you were given, and if you're wrong, take your lumps on being reversed. But I don't think you should take yourself too seriously. I think you should remember that you're just Craig, right? You're not Your Honor, like, at least outside the courtroom. I'm fortunate to have clerked in the Fourth Circuit where, like I said, the judges are very collegial, but also a number of judges are, they treat themselves as people. So, for example, former Chief Judge Wilkins, he would, after arguments, so in the evening, he would go to this bar with a couple of other judges and a couple of clerks. And he would, I didn't clerk for him, but, and so when I met him, he stuck his hand out, and he didn't call himself Judge Wilkins. He stuck his hand out and said, Billy Wilkins, right? Not even Wilkins, but Billy Wilkins, right? So Judge Traxler is the same thing. He introduced himself as Bill Traxler, right? So I think that says something about how they view themselves, that yes, in a courtroom, there's Judge Traxler or Chief Judge Wilkins at the time, or then Chief Judge Traxler. But in a social event, right, but that only lasts until the argument is called. And then they become regular people and they are self-deprecating and they are, and they treat clerks and litigants and, you know, Judge Traxler was gracious enough to meet my parents when they came down to Richmond and kind of interact like a normal kind of run-of-the-mill person. And I think that's important, right, to remember that you are really nothing special. You're given this power, just as in the courtroom, and you should. But once you're out of it, you're just like any other professional, whether it's a doctor, a lawyer, a plumber, a cab driver, and you should treat yourself that way.
Good advice. Any final thoughts, anything else that you want people to know about Judge Newman or this proceeding?
What I want people to know is that, look, Judge Newman is not doing this because she has nothing better to do with her life. She, like I said, she has so many other opportunities. She could be a mediator. She could be an arbitrator. She could be a law professor. Or, you know, she could just sip wine in France. She's lived in France before. She worked for UNESCO. She was, as she said in a number of her interviews, she was a bartender in France. She could do whatever she wants. So she's not doing this because she has nothing better to do or because, you know, she doesn't know how to do anything else. She's doing it because she truly believes in the role of the court, the role that she has on the court, and the constitutional structure of our government. And the reason we filed this lawsuit is for basically the same reasons. We are a public interest law firm. We're not a private law firm. We only take cases that advance our kind of what we believe is in public interest in specific areas. And we wouldn't have taken this case if we didn't believe that there's serious public interest issues at play.
Good place to end. Thank you so much, Greg, for doing this interview. I look forward to talking in the future again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harrity and Harrity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.